What's your emergency?
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the PIO Podcast, a place for all things public information related for police, fire, EMS, and local governments.
It was a good learning experience for a lot of us that social media is not real life.
But we have to remember the media are very rarely a target audience. They're simply that conduit.
Our words have impacts on individuals, and it may not be positive. So just being thoughtful and mindful of the words that we speak.
I think what's so interesting about this position too, and this job and this profession, is that every one of us is looking for purpose. And when we find it here, that's it.
To know is that a crisis for one is not necessarily a crisis for another.
Hey guys, I wanted to jump on here for a minute. I hope you're enjoying our content. If you could take a moment to look in today's show notes at the bottom, you're going to see a link that says support the show. The PIO Podcast needs support to keep connecting with these amazing resources. Any amount helps. Thanks, everybody. We really appreciate it. Hello, March. 2024 is truly moving quickly. We continue to discover and hear from other PIOs across the country this month. In April, we have some exciting news. We will hold our very first live panel discussion. More details on that will be coming as we move into March. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode. Good morning. Today on the PIO Podcast, we have public affairs specialist with the FBI, Shelley Lynch from the Charlotte, North Carolina office. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, Shelly, I appreciate you getting on. We tried to do this once before. It didn't work. Technology gets in the way. Nobody cares. It's all good. So let's talk about your background. You came from journalism, correct?
Yeah, I was in TV news for 16 years. I was a producer and an executive producer, and it was extremely demanding. As you know, there are tons of PIOs who used to be in TV news. And to be honest, there's probably a reason for that. And it isn't just because we're good at knowing how to send a message, right? It's probably in part because it's a better work-life balance. And that sounds kind of crazy to think that I cover the entire state of North Carolina and everything related to the FBI, and I still have a better quality of life and more time with my son than I did when I worked in TV news.
I can totally believe it. My daughter's a digital executive producer for an NBC station in Madison, Wisconsin, and I know what she has to deal with, and just that grind can be very tough.
Well, and on top of that, being able to use sort of your skills in a way for law enforcement, and really to kind of teach them how to work with the media, how to talk to the public, what sort of messages need to be put out, and when. I mean, that's pretty good to use your skills for that. But it's also amazing to be part of this law enforcement agency. Sometimes, honestly, it's kind of surreal where, I can go home from work and literally feel like I helped save somebody's life today. And I don't really know that you can do that in many other careers.
No. So why the FBI, though?
Why the FBI specifically?
How'd you end up there?
I had a former TV coworker who had sort of gotten into the Citizens Academy at the FBI, and she sort of got her foot in the door in that way, just really learning about it. And it isn't like you see on TV. It isn't just a bunch of FBI agents. And that's what I thought, to be honest. I didn't really know about all these other types of jobs. And so she sort of introduced it to me, and a job came open here in Charlotte just at the perfect time for me. And I was blessed that they were able to sort of see my background and realize that I might be a good person in this position. The Bureau started about 15 to 17 years ago. Rather than just having an FBI agent do this job as a collateral duty, they began to realize, you know, maybe if we are more proactive about different types of scams and crimes and things that we're seeing, maybe we can keep people from falling victim to that. And they started to dedicate people full-time to do it. And I'm really blessed that I'm one of those people.
How long ago did they start doing that? Because I remember the great Ross Rice from the Chicago office, who is kind of legendary out here. He was doing it forever, and he was never an FBI agent. So I don't know if it's just something that's been going on for a while and just has filtered into every FBI office.
So it still has not filtered into every FBI office. It is still up to the individual field office how they want to handle that position. The majority of them across the country now, the 56 field offices that we have, the majority of them do have a full-time professional staff person in that position, but there still are a few who may have an agent that does it as a collateral duty, or many times the chief division counsel. So the attorney for the field office would handle media relations as also that collateral duty.
Oh, that's got to be a pain to have an attorney on top of it too, and he's got to deal with all the other legal issues. That's got to be tough for that person.
I actually have the attorney in the office as my backup. And it is nice. Really fabulous to have him to talk to and to sort of give me that insight, not only as an agent, but as, you know, someone with this, you know, special training beyond just what we know is the law. Like, he knows it like the back of his hand, and what our, you know, restrictions are, what we're able to say and not say, and how we're able to do things. And he's really great at being able to be that sounding board for me.
Okay. Well, hey, that's awesome. So Shelley, let's talk about how the FBI gets involved in missing persons cases regularly. And can we discuss how you assist local agencies with that?
Yeah. So as I said before, I kind of hinted at, right, working with the FBI isn't like you see on TV. You remember that famous scene from Die Hard where they walk in, I'm Agent Johnson, and we're taking over, right? Well, that's not what we do. It really isn't. And especially in those cases, you know, we may not even have any type of jurisdiction at all for a missing child case. There may be nothing. And, you know, the whole point is that what we want to bring to the table for that is experience and resources. Many times, local agencies have never dealt with a missing child case. Or if they have, you know, it was something quick. Maybe the child just wandered away. You know, maybe the child really just was in the house hiding. You know, that's happened before, right? But we have people across the country who are dedicated to missing persons and specifically missing child investigations. They're called the Child Abduction Rapid Deployment Team. You know, we love our abbreviations and the FBI, so it's CARD. Now, I personally would not have called it the Child Abduction Rapid Deployment Team because that sounds like we're only going to get involved if a child was abducted, but that's really not true at all. There are agents and there are analysts and there's other people within the Bureau that go through specialized training all the time on how to search for missing children. They have proven techniques and tactics on the way to do it, and they are scattered throughout field offices across the country. So if, you know, we had one here in North Carolina, the Southeast team would come and aid us in that. And what I do is, you know, I've unfortunately been one of the public affairs officers in the FBI who has more experience than any others with missing children's cases. Now, I don't know what that means. I'm hoping what that means is because we have such fantastic relationships with law enforcement agencies in North Carolina that they are willing to call us for help right away, right? Not wait a few days, a few weeks, and then say, okay, we need to call the FBI. We want every agency does, every FBI field office just wants you to call us right away. We're happy to turn around and go home if you don't need us, but we'd much rather be deployed right away. And one of the things I do is I can come in, I can help with publicity, whether that's billboards, you know, our missing posters are on our social media sites that have 2 million followers each. We can put reward money up And I really work in a strategic way. So I am hearing what is happening in the command post, what the investigators are seeing, what they're saying. And then I'm working on what kind of message can I put out that's going to help drive that investigation forward. And we have seen that work many times rather than just, you know, I'm going to put out this basic piece of information or this basic release, you know, to be specific about it. Because you know what? The public, they're some of our best investigators. They're some of our best sets of eyes because they have seen things that we couldn't see. There's so many sets of eyes out in the public, and many, many times they are great assets to our investigations. And so I'm looking for ways to make that a better connection. What kind of tasking can I give to the public that is going to fill that piece of information that we need in our investigation?
So, Shoshelli, I'm sure when you were in journalism, you remember these lines from the FBI: we cannot comment on ongoing investigations, we cannot confirm ongoing investigation. So, can we? And in this era where transparency is always that word that's thrown around by not only the media but by the public in general. What are the reasons behind the not commenting on a current investigation, not releasing any information on a current investigation? This is, I think, something the public needs to be aware of, and why.
Yeah, so we're not just being mysterious or difficult. And to be honest, maybe I thought that's what they were doing when I was in the news, right? I would say, call the FBI. I know they're not going to say anything, but call them anyway. Well, getting on the other side then and seeing everything that goes into just opening an investigation. So we fall under the Attorney General guidelines, which have requirements of predication for just opening a case. So we don't just hear like, hey, we think that maybe you did something bad, so we're going to open a case and we're going to look into it. There's a lot more that goes into it. So we're following a lot of very specific guidelines and rules to do what we do. Therefore, we also fall under the Department of Justice policy, which is extremely strict. We can neither confirm nor deny an investigation. There are times when there is a civil rights issue, we can get specialized permission to confirm that investigation, for example, civil rights or a hate crime, perhaps. But we have to go all the way up the chain to DC, to the Department of Justice, to get approval to do that. I think that,
and it's not being evasive, it's following law.
It is.
Correct?
It is following the law and a federal law. And I say a lot of times to my media contacts, I'm not going to do anything that's going to get me fired or arrested. I'm going to help you as much as I possibly can. And I will point you to the places where you can find information when it's available. But I'm not going to do anything that's going to break the law, as you said. That's a great point. I mean, that really is it. We have much more strong restrictions than any other law enforcement agency about confirming investigations. And just think as well, like if you hear, you know, John Smith's being investigated by the FBI, what do you assume?
He's guilty.
And we don't want that.
He's guilty.
And we don't want that,
right?
Because we're just doing an investigation. We don't know where that investigation is going. We don't know if it's going to lead to charges. That's up to the U.S. Attorney's Office. We don't know if it's going to lead to a trial. We don't know if it's going to lead to a guilty sentence. So we're just not going to do it. It's not the right thing to do. We're balancing the law and also the right to privacy to that person.
And I think that's really important for the public to understand, because I think they're so used to like getting information, you know, that comes via the news or secondary sources. And it's really important, I think, for the public to realize that not only when police say that sometimes they can't provide information on an investigation, you guys are legally obligated to follow the law on that and not release any information. So it's very important for the public to be aware of that.
Can I make one more point that I think is really important and that people don't think about, especially in a crisis, a critical incident situation? So, for example, an active shooter or some sort of critical incident like that. I understand that the public and the journalists want to know everything that we know as soon as we know it. But I've heard other law enforcement professionals sort of explain it in one of the best ways that I've really ever heard. And that is, if we walk step through step on TV with you, as soon as we kind of get the facts ourselves, we are basically ruining the pool of eyewitnesses that we still need to talk to. So that eyewitness then hears what we've said on the news happened. And, you know, they're already talking to each other. They're already talking to their friends. And instead of ending up with an eyewitness firsthand account of what's happened, you're now getting what they heard, what someone else told them, what they think happened, what, you know, again, law enforcement is saying happened, and it may not be right. I mean, things are unfolding very quickly, and we just can't afford to taint that pool of people who can give us that eyewitness information. I know sometimes it can be extremely frustrating, and it seems like law enforcement just doesn't want to cooperate, but there really are true investigative reasons behind why and when information is released, at least when we're involved, and certainly when many law enforcement agencies are involved. It's not just, you know, we're not going to talk or we're trying to be difficult. There really are important reasons.
Yes, oh, I completely agree. And I appreciate you clarifying that for everybody that's listening, those that are not in the field as well, so that they have a better understanding. All right, so Shelley, let's change gears. How to do effective media relations with local agencies? How are you handling those? What are you doing to assist local agencies?
So a couple of things. I am trying to use my media background to help educate law enforcement. You know, unfortunately, there sometimes are those thoughts of us against them. And, you know, one bad experience with a reporter can ruin a relationship with a department. And one bad experience with a law enforcement agency, with that reporter, can also ruin those relationships. It goes both ways. Don't get me wrong. There's no way that I'm sitting here saying that any kind of negative relationship is only on a reporter and only on journalists. That's just not the case. It goes both ways. So a lot of what I try to do is work with local law enforcement agencies. I do different presentations or trainings to talk about, hey, how can we work with media? How can we talk with them? How can we help them see what we're doing and how we're doing it? And, you know, they do really get to be a little bit more understanding of, oh, okay, so reporters have a meeting in the morning where they're figuring out what their story is going to be for the day. They want to go in there and pitch a story idea, and they want it to be, you know, something that's going to be interesting and positive and good for the community. They don't want to go in that morning meeting without a story. They'll end up chasing scanner traffic all day. So if you have those relationships and you learn how to, you know, pitch stories, so to speak, then you have a better chance of getting that good story out there that you want, of your canines who had bulletproof vests, you know, donated, or, you know, whatever those types of things that help you connect to your community. I preach constantly. You know, I might have 38,000 followers on my Twitter account. My local media, they've got a market of 2 million people. I'm going to talk to them. I'm going to see how they can help me talk to my community. It's really important. They are your best voice to the public.
And the networking with them and working on those relationships, when you can say, hey, listen, I can't say anything about this, but you might want to be around until 2 o'clock and give me a call again. I might have more information.
Right.
And when they can trust that, it's mutually beneficial for both.
Yeah. And you also want to have those relationships ahead of time with other PIOs. You don't want the first time that you meet that police PIO or the sheriff's office PIO to be when something really bad happened. So,
So hold that thought, because I'm going to talk about networking with PIOs in a minute.
Okay.
But going back to the relationships with media, years ago when I worked for my first initial organization, we had an officer die in the line of duty. And during that time period, one of the Metro Chicago reporters was married to a Chicago police officer. She knew that three of the officers in our department went to the academy with her husband years ago. And she showed up at our station the day that the officer died, walked in, asked for one of the officers by name, and said, hey, you know, I just wanted to tell you I'm sorry. But then threw the camera and the microphone in their face.
Yeah.
You know, those are things, that's the wrong kind of relationship you want to have. I mean, if it's one thing where you want to say, hey, listen, I'm really sorry. If anybody wants to talk, we'd love to do an interview and walk away from it at that point. He'll let us know. That to me would have been better than showing up with a microphone and a camera.
Right. That is exactly right. So
I just want to throw that out there because I think it's important that we're not against, none of us are ever against having the media talk to people, especially at something like that, because it helps humanize the agents or the officers or whatever it is for sheriff's deputies or whatever. But we also don't want to have, it done surreptitiously in a sense.
In the same way, again, working in the other direction, you don't want the first time that, you know, you're trying to get that reported, hey, if you can hold off on reporting that right now, that would really be helpful to us. You know, don't report this, but, you know, we're tracking this guy. And if you put that out there, then he's going to see that we know this and this and that. You know, that's an example as well. If you have the trust and the relationships with your local reporters, then you can sort of wave them off of things like that. You can't expect them to do you, quote, a favor, and not really favor, but you know what I mean. Whenever,
right.
If you've never talked to them before, if you've done nothing but blow them off in the past, then you can't expect that, you know, they're going to, you know, understand where you're coming from in a situation.
Exactly.
Like that.
And listen, if you're chasing somebody across the country, you know, the second you do an interview with somebody locally, that's going to get picked up by another agency where you're looking for them. And obviously, it's going to get all over the news.
Yes.
And now, a word from our sponsor. In today's climate, you need to be able to communicate, whether you're communicating to those you serve, your peers, or your constituents, whether you're looking for professional development or to work with a professional. John Guilfoyle Public Relations has you covered. From crisis communications to website development, visit our website at jgpr.net or call us directly at 617-993-0003 to get started today. We'll help you tell your story strategically. Now let's return back to our episode. All right, so let's talk about how you network with PIOs across the country to help develop those relationships. What do you do? How are you networking with them?
So to talk specifically about FBI PIOs, they are such a great resource to me because I know that they are experiencing the same things that I am. So they have the same policies that I have. They have the same restrictions. They have the same technology even. You know, we've talked a little bit in the past couple of weeks about different sort of restrictions that we have security wise. So, you know, I can't go out and get a wireless mic and do an interview. I have to have a very specific mic that's, you know, been checked out. And, you know, unfortunately, you have to plug in directly to the camera, which is not always easy, right? But if I have a core group of people who, again, know about those same restrictions, and then they've also been through what I'm calling them about, probably. Most of the time, that can be challenging for us, right? So we, as, you know, public information officers, are trying to crank out our own, quote, stories. We're, you know, recording things where we need mics, we want good quality and all that. But yeah, we do have restrictions on the type of technology that we have. And even our phones. The phones that we have to have additional security on them that regular phones don't have. That is the nature of what we do and how we do it. But it can make it challenging for this job. So that's another reason why these FBI PIOs across the country are so important to each other, really.
Okay. All right, we're going to switch gears one more time. And this is a big issue. This is something that's been in the news pretty heavily, especially in the last month. I saw probably 30 articles across the country, if not more, in local papers about sextortion cases that are becoming extremely commonplace. So let's talk about the FBI's campaign to address the financial sextortion cases. And then we're going to go, I want to talk about some more things from that.
So what you've seen over the past month is a new campaign to, again, promote the rise in what we call financially motivated sextortion. So we are trying to get the word out to people about what's happening. Traditionally, what we saw was a pedophile whose motivation was to get sexually explicit photos from a child, usually a girl. And that was their motivation, was the sexual gratification. So they would get photos from a child pretending to be another child, and then it would turn to where they would threaten that child, send me more pictures, or I'm going to release these. I'm going to tell your parents. I'm, you know, maybe even threatening violence. But the shift we've seen in the past 3 years is now scammers have began to target children, and they are asking, rather than for more pictures, they're asking for money. And traditionally, who they are targeting is 14 to 17 year old teenage boys. It really is sort of mind-boggling to even think that this is something that somebody is dreaming up, and then they are literally spending their full-time job doing it. But we are seeing it across the country. We're seeing it around the world. One of the public service campaigns that we did was joining forces with 18 other countries, because that is how big and how growing this problem is.
I saw something in a recent article that said that according to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, they reported between 2021 and 2023 online enticement cases were up 323%. I mean, that's a staggering number. And then I saw something that nationwide, it was reported out of one, I think one of your offices in Texas, that nationwide there have been over 20 suicides based on this.
Yeah, and that is one of the reasons why we are pushing so hard to get this message out. What we've seen is these criminals are so ruthless that they don't care who they hurt, they don't care who they're targeting. And even in a case in Detroit, those criminals actually almost taunted and pushed the victim to take his life, which is hard to even fathom could happen. But the victim was telling them, you know, I'm going to do this. I don't know how I can live if you're going to release these photos. And they literally pushed him, said, do it. We don't care. That's what you deserve. It's hard to believe.
What can parents do? Because I think the number one thing is, I think parents need to, what can they do? What I know there's a your website, by the way, on that deals with this sextortion is phenomenal. So I'm going to link this in the show notes when we put this in here.
Thank you.
But what can parents do, please? What can we tell our kids?
So the number one thing we have to do is help them understand that everyone that they talk to on the internet is not who that they say that they are. You can pretend to be anybody you want to be. And what these particular criminals are doing is they are connecting to your child's friends. So then your child thinks, oh, well, John knows this person, so I can connect with them too when they send me that invitation. They actually have even sort of been so strategic that they will target a certain geographical area. So kids, you know, at the same school, in the same town, and friend all of those people. So then they look like they're legitimate. So, you know, the bottom line is if you haven't met this person in real life, then you don't know who they are. And my son is 20 now, and I wouldn't let him keep his phone in his room at night. I had him charge his phone in, you know, the den of our home, because inappropriate photos aren't taken in the den. So I took sort of that. I'm not saying our kids want to do that, but what happens in, especially in these cases, is these people are very smart. They groom our kids. They tell them what they want to hear. And in this case, with the financially motivated sextortion, it's almost like a very quick experience where they'll send a photo themselves that obviously is not of a real person, or maybe it is a real person that they use and multiple accounts. And so they will get a child to reciprocate sending the photo by sending one to them first. And then, you know, your chicken or, you know, you should send me one too. If I sent you one now, you know, I don't trust you. They use tons and tons of different tactics. So one of the ways that, to be honest, I just kind of took that decision-making out of my son's hands is not to let him have his phone in his room. And not to let him have his phone in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got to teach those, you know, good cyber habits. And it isn't just about this, but this is the most risky. And again, when you're talking about criminals who are so ruthless and so careless that they are pushing children, you know, to take their lives and they're taunting them, you have to do everything that you can. And so to lock down the settings on your phone, not accepting invitations from people you don't know, and really spot checking your child's phones. I know a lot of parents are reluctant to do that. That, you know, I've got to teach my child privacy. I have to help them understand how to do this. And this is not a privacy issue. This is a safety issue, because while your child is great at technology, they know tons of things about these phones and how they work and the apps that we don't. But what they don't have is our life experience. So they need that part to go along with, you know, the way that they know how to play this game. Because you know what? Those criminals are also on those gaming platforms. Those people are everywhere that your children are. So you need to know how to use those apps, and you need to make sure that your children are using them properly and responsibly.
I agree. You know, years ago, I used to teach a cybersecurity thing for kids, because back then it was just laptops and desktops. And now, because we have that the computer, the phone in hand that works better than most laptops and computers did 20 years ago, I mean, it's amazing how easy it is for kids to take a picture of themselves or to take a picture maybe with just their shirt off and, you know, maybe not fully exposed. And then now with the AI and the augmented reality stuff, maybe they're taking the head off of the body and putting it on another body.
They are doing that.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's another risk that's going on, is because now you're putting, it's not even a legitimate photo, but people think it is.
Yes. And they're using those same photos to also threaten and extort the children for money. And so they're having them send money through cash apps, through banking apps, even through crypto. Any way that they can, you know, part our children, unfortunately, now with their money, is what these guys are doing. And many of them they're overseas. So the case that I mentioned before in Detroit with the victim who sadly took his life and was almost pushed to that, those folks were arrested and they were brought back to the U.S. So it isn't impossible for us to find these people who are responsible and to hold them accountable, but it can be very difficult with them being overseas. And really, the power is in your hands. It's in your phone, whether you hit send or not. So don't hit send. And that's going to solve, you know, a lot of these risks.
Yeah, we really do. As a public and in law enforcement agencies, all of them need to be parroting what you guys are putting out on a regular basis, because this is something that, God, the emotional damage enough. You know, the financial damage, yeah, that happens. I mean, but the emotional damage to a young child or a teenager's brain, that they can't think clearly and they don't know, you know, what they're doing. And then a lot of them are coming out of the pandemic depression and stuff, and adding on to that, compounding by this. So,
yeah, they're good kids. They're our children. Yeah. They, you know, they are innocent. They don't understand what these awful people are plotting on a regular basis. They literally have so many strings and fishing lines going across the world on a regular basis, and they're just trying to reel in the next victim. And we've got to do everything we can to keep our children from becoming victims.
And let's face it, they're not targeting one, they're targeting thousands. Absolutely. At a time. So Shelley, thank you very much for bringing this up, because this is something that I think the public needs to be much more aware about. And I will make sure that I link the FBI's Sextortion Kids and Caregivers Need to Know page. I think that is phenomenal, and it is very important for the public to be aware of.
Thank you. And I have encouraged other public information officers that I know to take every bit of that. Use it all. Take the graphics, take the press release, rewrite it however you want to. I don't care if you put your logo on it. We just want the word to get out, because I think many times when we're talking about it, people still don't know what we mean by sextortion. And it's been going on. It's been going on for 10 years already. And now we've just had this shift that has become, you know, really a crisis. When it leads to young men taking their lives, it's critical.
All right, let's lighten this up, Shelley. Let's go to some rapid fire questions.
All right.
Texting or talking?
Texting all the way.
Chocolate or vanilla?
Chocolate.
Coffee or tea?
Ooh, neither really, to be honest. Every once in a while, I might have a peppermint version of one or the other, but I'm not a coffee drinker. I drink Monsters, which I know is bad for me. Everyone tells me so.
Adult drink of choice?
Ooh, I'm very basic. I'm just going to have a light beer if I have a drink.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Mind reading. Wouldn't that be great as a public information officer?
Oh my God, yes. That would be so awesome to know the questions coming first.
Well, and know what my bosses know, because sometimes they're not telling me everything that's going on.
Oh my God, yes. The Adam Myrick line, you know, I make sure that your PIO is not the last person to know, you know?
He's fantastic.
He's awesome. Ask permission or beg for forgiveness?
I am a hardcore rule follower, but in this case, I'm going to beg for forgiveness.
PIO way.
Mm-hmm.
Place you'd most like to travel to?
Greece.
First celebrity crush?
I'm going to date and possibly embarrass myself by saying John Bon Jovi.
Oh, no. He's still good looking. Guilty pleasure food?
Homemade mac and cheese.
That is that's comfort food.
Just like my grandmother made.
Yep. Who would you choose if you could have coffee with any historical figure, or monster with any historical figure?
Okay, so I'm going to call my friend Amy, who works for the FBI in Newark. And I'm going to ask her who she wants to go with, because I'm terrible at history. And then I'm just going to soak in their conversation, because she knows a lot more than I do about that stuff.
All right. What is there a question I should have asked? And if so, how would you have answered it?
I think the real question is, how can media and law enforcement work together? And I think that is by having that true understanding that we are doing the same thing. We all want to find the person responsible for a crime. We all want to hold them accountable. No one wants, you know, a bad guy to get away with things. And seeing how the other agencies are approaching things and having that understanding of, you know, this is what the news is doing and this is what law enforcement are doing, and we're not enemies, right? That is the most important. That's the most important thing to me.
Absolutely. Anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think it's really important for us, not just as PIOs, but as federal PIOs, as local PIOs, as emergency management PIOs, fire department PIOs, we need to work together as best we possibly can. And one of the ways I do that is by educating my local folks to understand, like, these are my restrictions. I totally get where you're coming from and what your policies are. And I'm not going to be mad at you that you're releasing something that I can't release. I think it's better to kind of have just that understanding that, you know, I'm going to pick up the phone and I'm going to call you and I'm going to say, hey, this is what I'm saying. And, you know, let me know what you're saying. I think sometimes people can, maybe in the heat of the moment, maybe under the gun, you know, say something about a case that at least the other agency doesn't know about. And I'm never going to do that. Like, I make a very, very huge effort to talk to another agency before I say anything about a case that we're working jointly. And I think that that is going to go a long way, whether I can say anything or not. I just like to give them that awareness that I've gotten the call. I don't want the news story to say the FBI is assisting in an investigation and that local agency doesn't know I confirmed it. I'm going to ask their permission, to be honest. So there is an ask the permission. I'm going to say, is it okay if I confirm that we're assisting?
Oh yeah. I mean, that's a given. You can't, nobody can ever speak for another agency. Absolutely. When I was working for the agencies I worked for, we never would ever just say, oh yeah, the FBI is on scene. I'd call and say, hey, can I say you guys are there? You know, I would never say that. I mean, that's the way it is. You got to ask.
Well, and sometimes they just see you, right? They just see us on the scene. I get it. But the calls are happening because they're just trying to get information from anybody they want to get it from, right? Anybody that they can get information from is who they're going to call. And I'm just going to make sure that I don't say anything that is about your case that you don't want me to say.
Completely agree. Shelley, how can people best reach you if they want to connect or follow up on anything they heard today?
Yeah, you can connect directly with me on LinkedIn, or you can email me at charlottemedia@fbi.gov.
And I will add all of that into the show notes.
Great. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, Shelley, thank you very much for being on the show. This is Shelley Lynch. She's from the Charlotte Office of the FBI. She's the Public Affairs Specialist. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. We hope you enjoyed this episode.
Thank you for listening. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast to get notified on the latest episode. If you are listening on a platform that allows you to leave a review, please give us a review. Any review is appreciated. To support our efforts with the PIO podcast, you can click on the support button in the show notes, and any donation is appreciated. Thank you.